There seems to be a lot of confusion in the debate about recovered memories of the nature and the difference of traumatic memory versus memory that can be recalled in a narrative way. And I guess, you know, we've been talking about some of the factors that why that happens, and I guess the physical and physiological workings of the brain not being able to process that through the hippocampus, or the hippocampus being overwhelmed by the experience and not being able to take in that and to give mm-hmm. sense to it.
And one thing that's very interesting is that some of the research has demonstrated that in Vietnam veterans, for instance, they have smaller hippocampuses, which doesn't prove this theory, but it supports the theory. And so I think what's significant here is that, and what's really important in the debate about recovered memory, is that there are a number of factors, actually. One is that the traumatic memory seems to be quite different from normal, ordinary, common, ordinary memory. And there's that difference between, as Bessel van der Kolk talks about, implicit memory and explicit memory. I believe that people are remembering their traumas in certain ways probably almost every second of their lives, that mm-hmm. they're reliving it emotionally. Their beliefs have been affected by them. They may feel, if they've been abused a lot, they may feel totally worthless. And that comes out of how they've been treated as a child in let's say, the abuse. And that's being relived all the time. The terror may be relived at practically every second of their lives. And in some ways, all that has to happen is the various fragments have to come together, and the awareness has to be connected. That, let's say, they're having particular recurring dreams that have particular images that actually relate to traumatic experience when they were a child. And let's say that they have certain fantasies that they don't know why they have these fantasies. And let's say that they're feeling a high level of panic or fear or grief or rage that's related to what happened to them. What has to happen is that they have to understand, or they have to somehow be able to connect all of these implicit kind of experiences with the explicit knowledge of what it's connected to. Mm. Now, the fact that we have to interpret implicit experience with explicit knowledge can get problematic, because our narrative kind of memories are not that accurate in certain ways. I mean, for instance, we've got, you know, the example I like to use is you have 10 people witness a car accident. Now, everybody knows that a car accident happened, but they may have 10 completely different versions of how it happened and who was at fault and what the sequence of events were or was. What will happen is that, so there are inaccuracies in explicit memory, and there are confusions in explicit memory. And there can be misinterpretations, because we have to use explicit means to interpret the implicit information. Mm. And that can be difficult, but I think that it's important to try to make those connections, and it also has to do with making the connections between the right and left brain. That more intuitive, sensory, emotional experience has to be, in trauma, it has to be reunited with verbal processing and understanding belief systems that have come out of traumatic experience.
So even though that somebody may be living with the implicit memories of a traumatic experience that happened, you know, even decades before, you know, throughout the series I've been talking to the more extreme forms of trauma in terms of government mind control, mm-hmm. which is very systematic and repeated, and often that people will be amnesic in terms of being able to say, well, you know, I was involved in these experiments, but at some point in their lives, something triggers this memory back, and they're able to put, I guess, the pieces of the implicit memory back together. And I wonder if you could talk about that process of remembering things that had happened decades before.
Okay, well, let's talk. I think what we need to talk about first is triggering, which is basically very much related to the associations we make. Let's say that someone was abused in a room of a particular color, let's say in a blue room, and the blue is a particular shade of blue. What may happen is every time they walk into a room or every time they see that color, let's say on somebody's clothing, they might start feeling sick. You know, they might start feeling in a rage. They might start having all kinds of reactions that they don't understand if the explicit memory of that event has been dissociated. Mm-hmm. But basically what they're doing is that they're getting certain kinds of implicit memory back in relation to that traumatic event. They just have a fragmentation that occurred so that they don't know what it actually relates to. And in fact, what they may do is that they may then think that it relates to something in the present. So they may start trying to find an explanation in the present day for all of those intense feelings that have just been triggered off, in other words, have been associated with that color blue. So what happens is that it's kind of a process where the amnestic barriers are starting to come down or the dissociative barriers, you could say, too, are starting to not be so strong, and that there's more co-consciousness among states, because when dissociation happens, there will be states that know that what happened. And in a way, I mean, Colin Ross talks about the fact that, you know, it's not really recovered memory, because some part of the individual has retained that memory all along, which is very interesting. That what happens is that identity may not have let that information become co-conscious with other identities within the community of identities inside one person. But what starts to happen is as the person is involved in some sort of life circumstance, or often when they're in psychotherapy, that there's more of an awareness of what's going on internally. That's part of what psychotherapy is about. It's to look at what is going on inside and what prevents the kind of changes that people want to make, and then how do you work towards making those changes so that their lives can become better. So what then starts to happen is that once these associations get recognized, and once somebody starts to understand the ways these mechanisms are working inside himself or herself, that it can actually be an opening for developing more and more awareness and give some of those identities or ego states, because not everybody who has had traumatic experience has dissociative identity. A lot of people have a kind of dissociation where they have very active ego states that are holding these kinds of experiences inside them, but they're not operating as what we used to call multiples, right? Mm-hmm. So that when the recollection process starts, it's really a process of increased awareness. There's a connecting, so that there's less fragmentation and less fragmentation among things like, you know, what the sensory experiences are and what the emotional experiences are and the explicit knowledge of the experiences. So in other words, if these experiences are related to a particular kind of abuse or a particular abusive experience, that memory starts to come back. Now, as I say, I mean, we can misremember something that happened last week, we get the general gist of something that happened, but we can get the details wrong. Mm-hmm. So we have to be very careful with how we do that recollection process, and you know, there are certain aspects of the recollecting that we can have a very strong feeling that yes, that's right, and you know, aspects of it, I think that because of the implicit information, we can have an inner knowing that yes, this really did happen in this way.
Right.
You know, if you know the smell of your father, right, and that smell was in the room when the abuse was happening, you can be pretty certain that that's who it was. Or if you have a flashbulb memory of his face, you can probably pretty accurately, explicitly interpret that.
Mm.
But there are other aspects that can get confused in that explicit interpretation of the implicit information.
Now, how does abreaction play a part in that, in terms of remembering and making sense of the implicit memory, and how does that how is that related to having flashbacks, like in terms of Vietnam vets, for example?
Okay, I mean, basically, what abreaction is, it's reliving traumatic events, and it's reliving it in probably a much less fragmented way than getting a little piece of, let's say, getting a visual flashback. Excuse me. What an abreaction can involve, I mean, it can involve many of the senses. It can involve, it often involves, in fact, I would say it always involves very strong emotional responses as well. It can also involve body sensations, so that the person can be feeling the pressure on their chest, or can be feeling the electric current of, let's say, they've been electroshocked, going through their body. Those are very powerful kinds of ways of remembering. They're not just, they're basically a reliving of the experience. And so that it's, it means that there's some way that it can be much more whole than just sort of getting a piece of a memory here and a piece of a memory there, maybe getting a smell here and getting just one image, almost as if it's a photographic image. Often people will get images of something that they may have focused on when something traumatic was happening. Something that a lot of survivors have done is when there's been something unbearable happening, they focus on a picture on the wall or a crack somewhere in the floor or, you know, a crack in the ceiling. And that might be an image that's always been with them, but they don't know what the significance of it is. But in an abreaction, what would happen is they might be very aware. They might be looking at that crack in the abreaction, but what they're experiencing is what's happening to their bodies and what's really, really what they're feeling inside themselves, all the emotional, the powerful emotional experience.
So is the process of abreaction just accessing a certain identity or part of yourself that does remember a more complete of what actually happened during the trauma, or is it the process of creating that co-cognition between, you know, the core self and those dissociated parts?
Well, I think it can be either, and it depends. It depends what part of the self actually experienced the original trauma. If the original trauma was experienced by a number of different identities, then the co-cognition would be necessary in order to have a full abreaction, the co-cognition of all of those identities that were there in the original experience. If the original experience was experienced by one identity, then there isn't any co-cognition that's necessary.
I see. But in terms of bringing that into, say, that experience happened within the one identity, does the abreaction somehow allow the person to be able to understand what happened in terms of being able to explicitly explain it after the ab reaction? Is there some kind of recognition in the person that what caused the trauma?
Often, yes. I mean, if somebody, it's amazing to witness ab reactions, because if somebody's going through, let's say, ab reacting an oral rape as a witness in the room, it's pretty definite that that's what's going on. Now, I never suggest that or never ask a leading question. My question is always open-ended, something like, can you tell me about what you just went through? But it's very frequently, if not almost always, that I had a pretty good guess as to what was happening to that person when they were going through the ab reaction, and when they then report what their experience was, it's usually very much what I guessed that it was from what their body was doing during that ab reaction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they may come out of the ab reaction and say, well, what I was going through is I was being orally raped. But they may not know who did it at that point.
Right.
And they may then explicitly start to try to guess, or they may wait for other kinds of ab reactions and flashbacks and other aspects of memory to get clues as to who it was, or they may never know who it was.
Now, you mentioned about body memories as being one of the types of implicit types of memory, and have you, in some of the people I've interviewed, they've talked about the actual body physically having, for example, reappearing burn marks or marks right on the body that relate to a memory that or an experience that happened in the past. Have you come across that?
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. And it's almost, I mean, there's some research going on in this area, and people are postulating that there's such a thing as cellular memory, which is very interesting to think about. But we don't know exactly what's going on here. But certainly, you know, it's this idea or this experience of having, let's say, a burn mark reappear, it does happen. I've witnessed that happening, and it's quite profound. You know, somebody walks in the room and they don't have that mark on them, and then they go through an ab reaction, or they start to get a memory. They may not even be an ab reaction, and suddenly a mark appears. And then maybe that's the beginning of an ab reaction, or it may take weeks or months to get the memory that goes along with that. I mean, I think that it's my interpretation anyway, is that it's part of that same experience of how memory is encoded in many different ways, and it seems to be encoded in some way in our body, so that when we have an ab reaction of something that happened 20 or 30 or 40 or more years back, that our bodies can re-experience it in an ab reaction as if it's happening right there in the moment, so that, you know, somebody can think that they can't breathe because, let's say, that part of what happened was that they were smothered. Or, you know, somebody feels the pressure on their chest, or feels, or is choking, or I mean, the way the body is going during an ab reaction is something that somebody probably could not try to do, sort of consciously make themselves do. I mean, it's a very different kind of phenomenon from when somebody just sort of acts it out.
That's just amazing to think, and just in terms of, you know, your example of feeling, you know, for somebody that's experienced electroshock, for example, and to re-experience the feelings of the electricity again. So that may be not just a memory in their brain, that may be actually something going on in their nervous system that they can actually feel that electricity again, or their cells or their body is experiencing that reaction again.
That's right. And let's say, I mean, you know, our reactions, our emotions, there's a chemical change. There's a neurochemical change. Different neurotransmitters are activated, you know, when we're burned. You know, And it may be, I mean, it would be very interesting to look at this, that if somebody's going through an ab reaction, or that they're having a body memory, or a, let's say a burn mark reappear, that it would be very interesting to look at biochemically what's happening inside that person's body to see if the same kind of neurotransmitters are being stimulated and activated, and that their levels are being elevated during something like that.
Mm-hmm. So for somebody that has had repeated experiences of abuse and are dissociative, what is the healing process, or what is the process of healing in terms of your understanding?
I think that one of the important things that has to happen is that the person has to overcome the fragmentation. That if there isn't co-consciousness, and if there isn't, you know, if the emotions aren't related, for instance, to that visual flashback, that the whole of that memory hasn't been processed, and there's still a block. It's almost like a neurological block that operates like a scratch in a record, you know, and just seems to make that experience repeat and repeat and repeat in some sort of form, that fragmented experience. So what has to happen in the healing process is that the person needs to overcome the fragmentation, so to bring the implicit memory together with explicit, to process verbally, so that the experience is not just traumatic experience locked in implicit memory, but that so that there's a processing and an understanding. I think there needs to be some serious cognitive work done too, to look at how did that trauma affect the person's belief system. What patterns have developed that have caused that person to act in certain ways? What kinds of interferences are there in relationships? So there need to be some real working on understanding the effect of the trauma in their lives, throughout their lives, and also in looking at, okay, how do I then move forward and change this in my life now? So it's a process that I think what we're realizing now can be done in a lot of different ways. I mean, there are a lot of new therapies that are coming out that different people have had different kinds of success with. So, for instance, something like EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, where somebody looks at basically, they move their eyes back and forth. There are many ways to do it, but that's one way to do it. They move their eyes back and forth, similar to how somebody's eyes move in rapid eye movement sleep. And for some reason, and there are theories about why this works, it really seems to start to open up memories. It can also help the person reprocess beliefs that they have in relation to those memories. And it seems to overcome certain kind of dissociative barriers. It's something that you have to be it's kind of therapy you have to be very careful with, because it's very, very powerful. There are other kinds of therapies like thought field therapy that are based on the energy, like the meridians, the Chinese medicine acknowledges in our bodies, and that manipulates the fields and in relation to people's histories. But I think that we don't know completely how the healing needs to take place. We know we have certain techniques, we have certain things that we have varying kinds of success rates with, but I think that there are approaches that we know, if they're used in conjunction with other approaches, can be very successful. For instance, too much ab reaction can mean that somebody gets overwhelmed and has trouble functioning in their lives. But a certain amount of ab reaction can be very powerful, also paired with other kinds of therapy, to you know, looking at cognitive therapy, for instance, psychodynamic therapy, different kinds of ways of really processing what happened to the person, and what's the meaning of it, and ego state therapy is very important to try to get the various identities to know each other. There's a kind of group therapy that you have to do in ego state therapy, basically, so that the identities can learn how, the identities who are in conflict can learn how to navigate the world together and can build alliances with each other so that they're operating in the world in harmony, not in terrible adversity.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that different people have to have different ways of healing, and do you feel that's related to the way people process information in terms of, like, either visually or orally or kinesthetically?
Very much so. Mm-hmm. And I mean, what I find both fascinating and wonderful and challenging as a psychotherapist is that each person's process is very individual, and I can draw from my knowledge, and I can draw from various modalities, but that really the individual, herself or himself, is going to have specific needs and specific knowledge about what she or he needs to do in the process.
Now, I'd like to talk about how you understand mind control, I guess versus more innocuous forms of social influence.
Okay, well, again, it's not, for me, it's not a versus, it's a continuum again.
Okay.
So it let's go back to Pavlov and his dogs. that you know, Pavlov played a metronome before he fed his dogs food, and fed a dog food. And what would happen is that eventually, after doing this a number of times, the dog would start to salivate any time he heard the metronome. And to the point where, even when he didn't get food, if he heard the metronome, he would start salivating. And what's happening here is there's an association that the dog is making between the metronome and getting food. And then it becomes a physiological mechanism that's triggered off so that the dog starts to salivate. Well, learning is all based on this. The way, not only learning, but socialization is all based on this. So, for instance, if a child, every time he or she gets angry, is told that she's misbehaving because she's angry, and let's say that she's punished or maybe even abused when she gets angry, what she's going to start learning is that anger, that her anger and what she's starting to express or how she's starting to behave is not all right, and that maybe then fear comes in because maybe she's abused horribly when she gets angry. So she may learn then to dissociate away from the anger. And what's really happening is a phenomenon that's exactly the same as Pavlov's dog salivating. And that learning, I mean, when somebody learns, again, there are associations that are made. And if they read, let's say they're learning to read, when they learn words, they get rewarded for those words so that they may be motivated to read. Or let's say somebody has some sort of learning disability that they try to read, but they get very frustrated. And that then the association that's made is that I try to read and I'm very frustrated. Okay, so these are just regular processes that everyone goes through, and we learn, you know, we learn certain things by our experiences when they occur.
We've been listening to an interview with Gail Fisher Taylor, and part two of this interview will be aired next week. And in 2 weeks' time, we're going to have a panel discussion on ritual abuse and healing for survivors with Elise Murphy and Gail Fisher Taylor and Karen Stardancer. The following week, we're going to have a panel discussion on government military mind control with Walter Bowert, and that will conclude the radio series on mind control here. On those two panel discussions, you'll have a chance to phone in and ask questions or voice your concerns around these issues. Tapes and transcripts of this whole radio series are available at CKLN, and you can call 595-1477 during office hours to ask about that. You've been listening to The International Connection on CKLN 88.1. Coming up next, a key in Western America.